This is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by West Virginia University, offering education, healthcare, and the opportunity to achieve career success since 1867. Information at wvu.edu. Embassy Suites by Hilton Charleston, an all-suite hotel and conference center minutes from Yeager Airport and Capital Market. Reservations and brasserie dining information available at hilton.com.
Solar Hauler, supporting Appalachian communities and building on West Virginia's history of powering the nation by bringing solar energy and battery backup to homeowners, nonprofits, and businesses throughout the region. More at solarhauler.com.
Welcome to the Legislature Today. I'm Curtis Tate. The vaccine exemption bill mentioned in yesterday's episode was slated for a third reading today, but has been laid over a day. Legislators have told WVPB that the bill likely won't be voted on until Friday. In other news from the Senate floor, the lead sponsor withdrew his bill that would have removed exemptions for rape and incest in West Virginia's near-total abortion ban. In a press release, Jay Taylor, a Republican from Taylor County, noted that he had received threats directed toward his family. Wind generation in the state receives a break in the tax code that treats it as a form of pollution control. A bill now moving through the Senate aims to repeal that tax break. The Senate Energy, Industry, and Mining Committee approved the Creating Wind Power Taxation Clarification Act earlier this week. It now goes to finance. In 2023, the legislature banned gender-affirming care for minors with narrow exceptions for hormone therapy. Now, a more conservative Senate is moving to do away with those exemptions. A bill sponsored by Chris Rose, a Republican from Monongalia County, would ban hormone therapy for new and existing patients under 18. Brianna Heaney brings us this story.
The Senate Health Committee heard testimony from medical professionals and from advocates of the bill. Dr. Chantel Weissenmuller, president of the West Virginia Psychological Association, told lawmakers that stopping gender-affirming care for teenagers is risky and detrimental to their health.
As a psychologist, that is a very frightening prospect for me because from clinical lived experience, whenever folks suddenly lose access to this necessary, evidence-based, best practice medical treatment, we see a marked, significant, intense escalation in depression, anxiety, and suicidality.
An amendment was offered by Senator Joey Garcia, a Democrat from Marion County, that would grandfather in existing patients who are receiving hormone therapy.
We've heard from West Virginia practitioners and the West Virginia Association for Psychology representative about the potential harms, including increased harms, for someone that's currently undergoing medical treatment under the exception that's in law, especially if it's done immediately.
The amendment was rejected. Rose, the lead sponsor of the bill, said no minors in the state should be receiving hormone therapy.
The reason this bill is necessary in the first place is there's never a medically necessary reason to trans a child. There's never a medically necessary reason to chemically castrate or sterilize a child for a mental illness. You get them mental help. There is therapy for that, but never is it justifiable to permanently alter their body with something that's irreversible.
Simon Amaya Price from Boston, Massachusetts, appeared before the committee virtually. He says for a brief time during his adolescence, he believed he was female. Now, a freelance speaker, he advocates for bills like West Virginia Senate Bill 299.
The more desisters and detransitioners I talk to, the more I realize just how close I was to being permanently disfigured, disabled, and becoming a lifelong medical patient. At the moment, the law in West Virginia says that if you get the sign-off from two doctors, you can receive puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones as a minor. In my case, I had four who would have done that.
The bill passed the Senate Health Committee and now heads to the Senate Judiciary Committee. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brianna Heaney at the Capitol.
Changes to the House of Delegates committee procedure this year are meant to make the legislative process more deliberative. In the first week of the session, that appears to be the case. Of the 616 bills introduced to the body so far, two passed the chamber, and just one more has been placed on first reading in the House. The others are still in committee. The Senate is off to a similarly slow start, with just four of the 544 bills introduced to the chamber advancing past first reading. Committees like House Education have yet to put a single bill on their agenda, opting instead to focus on things like budget presentations and agency reviews. The House Health and Human Services Committee spent more than 3 hours Tuesday evening deliberating over two bills related to food sales in the state. 2 hours of debate centered around House Bill 2354, which would add seven food dyes to the list of banned food alterations. Both bills discussed Tuesday are again on the Health Committee's agenda Thursday for amendments and voting to advance to the House chamber. Before the current legislative session started, we wanted to put the state budget in perspective. Governor Patrick Morrisey says the state is facing a $400 million shortfall, but many in the legislature are not so sure. Keelan Bailey looked into it for us.
During his first week in office, Governor Patrick Morrisey delivered a picture in stark contrast to outgoing Governor Jim Justice's projections of upcoming fiscal strength for the state.
The state will have a projected deficit of approximately $400 million, and that number is projected to rise more and more in the out years. This is where we stand on day one.
In the time since, Morrisey has made it clear that his office sees these issues as inherited and structural, pointing to one-time funds used for large ongoing costs like Medicaid rather than finding consistent funding sources. Senator Eric Tarr is the outgoing Senate Finance Chair, having held the seat for 3 years.
It's coming across as more dire sounding than it is. You figure we're going to have probably $5.5-6 billion in revenue that come into the state.
Tarr says he has worked to create flat budgets with the legislature. While Justice ceased providing six-year budget projections during his time in office, a practice Morrisey plans to bring back, Tarr worked with available legislative data to create revenue reports within a margin of error. Still, he says Justice's priorities could diverge from the concrete realities of running the state.
Governor Justice was a very big picture guy on going out and, you know, let's tackle the biggest mountain we can find, and really, sometimes there wasn't so much a plan for tackling that biggest mountain you could find. But that went at sometimes the sacrifice of having somebody who really had an operational knowledge of the agencies.
While Tarr is optimistic about Morrisey's approach, he says Morrisey's plan to audit all expenditures over $100,000 could still be difficult. In the meantime, Tarr says he expects job growth through past legislative funds designated to companies like Nucor, but that growth just comes a little later than expected within projections' margin of error. And incoming jobs will also mean an incoming demand for social services.
You have people who are coming in order to go to work. They need child care for their kids in order to be able to get away from the house to go to work. Rather than somebody having child care and still sitting at home, which is things we've also had to contend with in West Virginia.
But those services, like health care costs and investments in child care, have always been in the push and pull of balancing the state budget with years of tax cuts. Sean O'Leary is a budget analyst at the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. He says the state's position with those social services, which often enable and attract workforce participation, are already weakened.
The risk that you run when you make cuts to those services is that you make the state uncompetitive to our neighbors when it comes to public services. We already spend less per child on child care. We already spend less per student on K through 12 education. We already spend less on health care and Medicaid. That's not good for the state.
As for the promise of tax cuts, O'Leary said the state's strategy for job growth has long been lagging.
We've been down this path before. We tried this under the Manchin administration by cutting the corporate net income tax, the business franchise tax, the parts of the income tax, and the sales tax. At the time, it was called the most pro-growth tax reform in the country. And it was supposed to create jobs. It was supposed to pay for itself. All of these things ended up costing in 2015, when they were all fully in effect, cost about $425 million, which you adjust for inflation, it's about the size of the income tax cuts that we've recently passed. And since then, West Virginia has lagged the rest of the nation when it comes to job growth. We've had flat job growth.
And many federal funds, like Medicaid expansion, are no longer in play for the state budget as pandemic-era federal bills have lapsed. This lapse also comes amid questions about what President Donald Trump will preserve as he plans to reassess and cut trillions in federal program funding. Morrissey says almost half of the state's overall budget currently comes from federal funds. O'Leary says his analysis sees a need to preserve social programs while passing legislation that thinks more expansively about the potential for taxes that would not be levied against most of West Virginians directly.
You know, we could keep the current income tax cuts and add new brackets on top so that no one below $100,000 would see their taxes increase and would still raise hundreds of millions of dollars doing that. You know, almost close our budget gap just by doing that alone. Looking at the business franchise tax that, you know, we eliminated it entirely and it did very little for the economy. Bringing that back could bring it back a substantial amount of income.
The governor releases his annual budget proposal along with his state of the state on the first day of the legislative session. From there, it's up to the state legislature, including new Senate leadership, to come up with a budget that both chambers can pass and the governor will sign. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, this is Keelan Bailey in Charleston.
Earlier today, our health reporter Emily Rice spoke with Jim Kaufman, president and CEO of the West Virginia Hospital Association, and Jessica Dobrinsky, chief of staff and certificate of need policy expert at the Cardinal Institute for West Virginia Policy, about changes lawmakers are proposing to state code.
Hi, my name is Emily Rice. I am West Virginia Public Broadcasting's health reporter. Today, I'm joined by a couple of experts in the topic that we're going to be discussing today, which is certificate of need, colloquially known as CON. So we're going to be talking about CON a whole lot, and that can get confusing in committee meetings. So I wanted to get that right off the bat. Certificate of need is CON. So I'm joined by Dr. Jim Kaufman, the president and CEO of West Virginia Hospital Association, and Jessica Dobrinsky. You're from the Cardinal Institute of West Virginia Policy. You're their chief of staff and a policy expert on this exact topic. So thank you guys so much for coming over today. I really appreciate it. If we could just get started, Jessica, if you would just go ahead and kind of explain what certificate of need is, and because that the phrasing, I think people get a little bit confused by it.
Yeah, certificate of need actually is a little bit of a complicated issue. It was introduced in the 1970s, and it was passed down by the federal government and asked states to do the same. And the intent was to improve quality, improve access, and lower costs for healthcare. And unfortunately, none of those things came true. And so the federal government has asked states to repeal it. And what certificate of need really operationally looks like is it requires new and existing healthcare providers to ask a government agency if they're allowed to open a new facility or expand an existing practice. So any modification, even for an existing facility, is required to get that certificate of need. And uniquely, their need methodology only really looks at economic viability rather than quality measures that are typically otherwise, you know, held up in healthcare policy.
Okay. What about Dr. Kaufman? How would you define certificate
sure,
of need?
Sure, I would define certificate of need as a tool that 35 states are using okay. to help hold down healthcare costs. In West Virginia, it's actually been successful to really make sure you have a sufficient patient population mm-hmm. to ensure quality programs and good outcomes. And I can give you great examples in West Virginia where we've actually modernized the program, so it is an effective planning tool.
Yeah, and absolutely, I think it's so interesting to have experts with differing opinions on something like this. Because that's exactly the conversations that we're having in these committees. So, with that understanding of certificate of need, it's something that if a healthcare center in West Virginia, any sort, wants to expand or offer anything else, they need to ask our government for certain permissions and if that service is needed in that area. Is that fair to say that that is the general idea?
That's the concept, but actually there are several things that are exempted from certificate of need that people don't understand.
Yes.
So for example, private practice physicians can open a practice anywhere in West Virginia without a CON. A hospital can expand services on their existing campus without a certificate of need. So the state has actually done a great job over the years of modernizing the program to make sure that it's working for the current environment.
Okay. So that's actually, it leads really well into what I was going to talk about. In 2023, there was some legislation that went through to remove the certificate of need for birthing centers. And that's really, I feel like when, at least from my perspective, the conversation really kicked up and certificate of need became
a household term that people were using. You know, Governor Morrisey has mentioned it, I think, in a few major speeches. You know, can you tell me about, and I'll start with you, Dr. Kaufman, I remember you testifying during some of that. Tell me about that legislation and how it came about.
Sure, the legislation was actually a couple pieces. It, one, eliminated the requirement for an existing hospital to get a certificate need to expand services on their existing campus. It also raised the capital expenditure threshold from $5 million to $100 million. And it also eliminated the certificate of need for birthing centers in the state of West Virginia. And what's interesting, people were saying that if we get rid of CON, we can have these additional services. To the best of my knowledge, since that bill has passed, no birthing centers have opened in West Virginia. We still have only one that was actually in existence prior to that legislation.
Okay. And from your perspective, Jessica, we had spoken before a little bit about that exact legislation. Were you up at the Capitol while that was happening? And what have the outcomes been from, you know, the Cardinal Institute's perspective?
Yeah, so at the Cardinal Institute, we do a lot with community outreach, and we had the pleasure of speaking with a lot of nurse midwives who are really passionate about removing certificate of need for their care. One important thing to note is that despite it going being passed into law in 2023, it really only has been in effect for a year in 2024. And of course, the economy hasn't been the best, so it is difficult for some of these facilities to open. Another thing that I'd add is that, you know, birthing centers also have a huge lump of other regulations on top of it that make it difficult to open. And birthing centers also have to have, in order to operate, agreements with hospitals right now in order to transfer in case something goes wrong to emergency rooms. And unfortunately, we've heard from some of our past partners that those transfer agreements are very difficult to get from these hospitals.
Okay. And I think that also leads into some of the discussion that's been going on in committee, and I actually was going to ask, you know, where do you think this push is coming from to deregulate? Where did it come from initially? And I'll let either one of you take that one. I think a perspective would be great from either of you, where it's obviously from a federal level as well in 2025, but where do you think the push to deregulate is coming from?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to recognize that this is something the federal government asked states to do and then rescinded almost immediately. And every single presidential administration since Ronald Reagan actually has agreed on this one thing, that states should remove it. It's failed to improve cost or quality or access. And so a lot of these issues have, you know, healthcare is a little bit of a mess just generally in the nation. And so as we're talking about those three major issues, you know, this is a really good first step, is talking about how certificate of need is really a barrier to these people.
Okay. And I forgive me for putting words in your mouth, but I feel like you may say that those kind of regulations are stopgaps and safety points to keep areas from being over inundated with certain kind of services?
Or what really certificate needs looking at is how do you ensure that there's a sufficient patient population to support a program? For example, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about free market and healthcare, where healthcare is not a free market. And generally everybody that you talk to, including researchers that work on this, would agree that healthcare is not a free market. So when you start to look at certain services, I hear one thing, well, why can't we have X service in this community? And I would also point out that you don't have a Chick-fil-A in some of these communities because you need a sufficient population to support a service. And that is something that we, you know, especially in West Virginia, it is a struggle because of our rural nature and our sparse populations. How do you ensure enough patient population to ensure a quality program? And research has shown over and over again, the more you do something, the more proficient you're going to be at it. So we want to make sure you do have positive outcomes and there is a population to support those programs.
And did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would push back to that claim just a little bit, because while healthcare certainly isn't a free market, it certainly responds to free market principles. And another important thing to recognize in healthcare, whereas it's a little bit different in Chick-fil-A, it's not elastic. If there's no Chick-fil-A, you can go to a McDonald's, but if there's no healthcare service, there's just a lack of access and you don't get treatment for sometimes things that can be deadly.
Okay.
When we're talking about a free market, tell me one other sector of the economy where government is setting the price for the good below cost. And that's the problem we have in situations in West Virginia, where right now the average hospital in West Virginia, 75% of our patients that we care for, we're getting paid by government, Medicaid, Medicare, and the Public Employees Insurance Agency below the cost of care.
Okay, that is on my, to talk about that payer mix, but with our last few minutes here, I do want to jump onto the legislation that is actually being discussed, that I believe both of you have testified to lawmakers about. these bills. Tell me about what changes are being proposed this session. Dr. Kaufman, if you'd like to start
out. Sure. Basically, the governor's bill is to completely repeal their certificate of need program. And we're very concerned because we believe it would undermine the healthcare delivery system in West Virginia. When you look at it right now, we believe the program is actually working in West Virginia. When you talk about cost, when you look at the average inpatient day, West Virginia ranks fifth in the country as the lowest. So we're actually, it's achieving that cost. One of the biggest problems that we have is workforce. There's a shortage of healthcare professionals all across the country. And again, going back to our payer mix, it's a challenge to recruit physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, other providers to the state with such a low payer mix and our rural nature.
So your concerns are broadly for the state, obviously, as well with workforce. I listened to your testimony as that as well, but I apologize. I don't want to get off topic. Yeah, if you could tell me about the legislation, what changes, you know, from the Cardinal Institute's perspective. I was looking at a few press releases. You know, these are celebratory things for your institute. What kind of changes and kind of pros would we be looking at with these kind of changes?
Yeah, so at the Cardinal Institute, we do a lot to educate on this policy, and we've kind of looked at a lot of other states, Montana being one of them, that is largely rural and had a almost full repeal of certificate of need a few years ago and has seen great growth. In fact, the rural communities actually benefit largely from certificate of need repeal. In fact, research shows us that there's a 92 to 112% increase in ambulatory surgical centers with the removal of certificate of need. Again, 11% higher costs, and I understand concerns with the payer mix, but this is increasing the cost even for Medicaid and Medicare. And with tight state budgets, that's really important too. So, improving quality, increasing access, and lowering costs is really valuable in the removal of certificate of need.
Excellent points on all fronts. I really appreciate your all's time. We do have a little bit more time if we do want to talk about rural challenges. That was a really big topic. We have a little bit of time to talk about rural challenges and critical access hospitals. Just very quickly speak to challenges that we face, you know, from the hospital perspective.
Sure. When you look at it, you know, of the hospitals that we represent, about a third are critical access hospitals, and these are a federal definition of how they're reimbursed differently. But to give you an example of how they're getting reimbursed below the cost of care, people talk about, you know, allowable costs for these critical access hospitals, and this is set by Medicare, but it's allowable cost minus 2%. So right there, you're already in the hole on those patient populations. The concern that we have is actually the cherry picking of services because, you know, not all patients, when they come into the hospital, the insurance company pays the same. So there's actually an economic incentive for those that are coming into the state to cherry pick those services, treating those higher cost patients, the commercial pay patients that reimburse better, leaving rural hospitals and other providers with Medicaid, Medicare, PEI patients, which we're getting paid below the cost of care, which then loses your ability to support programs that the community wants.
Right. And with the last of our time, I'll allow you to your rebuttal to that?
Yeah, we hear a lot about cherry picking, but There's plenty of states that have repealed certificate of need, and none of that has come to fruition. Unfortunately, it's a tactic used to kind of defend systems that are not serving patients properly.
Right. Understood. We'll see what happens. You know, it's up to our lawmakers, and, you know, that's why we have these conversations, and we have our differences, and I just want to thank you all so much for your time today and coming over to our studios to discuss this. I know it's Wednesday, but it has been quite the week so far, and braving the weather as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. I look forward to speaking to you all in the future. I imagine this topic isn't going to go anywhere anytime soon. So thank you so much. And thank you all. Back to you.
That's it for tonight. Thank you for joining us. Catch the Legislature today, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. And remember, West Virginia Public Broadcasting covers the session daily in our radio news program, West Virginia Morning, and on our news site at wvpublic.org. We also broadcast the daily floor sessions of both the House and the Senate on the West Virginia Channel. I'm Curtis Tate. Good evening, and see you here again tomorrow.
Support for the legislature today is provided by West Virginia University, offering education, healthcare, and the opportunity to achieve career success since 1867. Information at wvu.edu. Embassy Suites by Hilton Charleston, an all-suite hotel and conference center minutes from Yeager Airport and Capital Market. Reservations and brasserie dining information available at hilton.com.
Solar Hauler, supporting Appalachian communities and building on West Virginia's history of powering the nation by bringing solar energy and battery backup to homeowners, nonprofits, and businesses throughout the region. More at solarhauler.com.